Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. My name is Morty Yalofsky, and on behalf of the campus community, I'm pleased to welcome everyone here to today's forum. The forum, which was titled Navigating the Medicare Maze. And this is a topic which may not be as hot a topic as other topics in Quebec right now, but certainly this is something that we all think about in terms of the complexity of the healthcare system, in terms of what are the facts and what is the fiction associated with it, and also what will Medicare be able to, or the Quebec healthcare system, be able to meet our future needs as well as the needs of our families. We're fortunate that we have two speakers today, two presenters, both of whom are part of the McGill community, and both of whom have excellent reputation and certainly are knowledgeable in the area. One is Dr. Howard Bergman, and the other is Professor Antonio Maione, both of whom, Howard is also a professor within McGill itself. The way we're going to run the program is first Antonio will speak for approximately 20 minutes, followed by Howard, and then we'll open ourselves up for questions. Because this program is streamed live, we have some microphones that have been placed in various different parts and people will walk around. So if you do have a question, please go move towards one of the microphones so that you can ask the question. Antonia is certainly well known within the McGill community. She is a professor in the Department of Political Science as well as affiliated with the Institute for Health and Social Policy. She's a past director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and at McGill she is a William Dawson Scholar. She is certainly known for her focus on public policy, social policy, and of course healthcare reform within the community. Today, Antonia is going to go ahead and give us some background on the present day situation with the health system, how it's evolved, and some concepts in terms of where we think we might be helping. The second speaker is Howard Bergman, and I can say Howard and I have known each other since we were wearing shorts almost, many years. Howard is a professor in family medicine and oncology, and as recently as May the 1st, he was put forth as the chair of the Department of Family Medicine within the university itself. He's known for his work in primary care, aging, chronic diseases, and health services. He's been an active researcher. He's been, or still is, the vice president. You had to give that up? Okay, of Scientific Affairs for the FRSQ, and has many other achievements. Today, what he will be speaking about will be effectively the challenges of meeting the needs of an aging type of population as we move into the 21st century, and he's going to have reference with respect to the Alzheimer group, and after all, he did lead an expert panel several years ago that went ahead and set up the Quebec Alzheimer policy going forward. So you'd rather hear the speakers than myself, so I'll first call on Professor Antonio Maione to present the first part, followed by Howard Bergman.
I hope you can hear me. Can you see me? I don't have my little riser, so I'm not quite sure. Thank you very much, Morty. As my kids often point out to me, I'm not a real doctor. So I'm going to be talking about healthcare in terms of some of the political issues surrounding healthcare reform in Canada. And we had a bit of a snafu, a little technical snafu. So this is actually the slightly older version of my slides, but I'm going to bring it up to date as I speak with you. And what I wanted to do today is talk to you about where we are, where we've come from in terms of healthcare in Canada, and hopefully some ideas about where we're going. I always start a conversation about healthcare and healthcare reform by saying, wouldn't it be nice if there was a magic pill out there that could actually solve all the problems that we have in the healthcare system today? Sort of like a magic pill, perhaps, to solve the student situation as well in Quebec today. But in healthcare, something that would really sort of speak to some of the concerns and challenges that we have. But more often than not in Canada, it turns out to be this, that healthcare is really a political football, and that it's been used in that way for years, and that sometimes when we talk about reforming the healthcare system, it's not just about healthcare, it's actually about the political context in which some of these decisions about our healthcare system get made. So, in my family, good things come in threes. I have three wonderful young boys. So my presentation today, community, thought I'd share this photo of the kids with you, but what I thought I'd do then is divide my talk into three as well. So what I'd like to do is three things. First of all, talk about some critical moments in the past that have brought us to where we are today, some flags on our current situation, and then moving forward to where we're headed. But I think that that last part of the equation is something that will be taken up by my colleague, Dr. Bergman, and also hopefully will come out of the discussion that we're going to have after the two talks. So let's start with the past. Many of you already know this story, but it's good for us to all kind of get on the same page about how we got to where we are in healthcare in Canada. And as most of you know, prior to 1940, there wasn't much in the way of a healthcare system, or at least a publicly funded healthcare system in Canada. Healthcare was actually considered something that was in the realm of private business, and also something that families or communities or even religious groups were in charge of, particularly in the province of Quebec. There's also the impact of federalism, which is important in understanding the past in Canada, the fact that if you look at the Constitution, there is no mention of the words health insurance or health care. We say that provinces have responsibility over health care because of their constitutional responsibility over hospitals. But if you think about what actually could have happened, right, in the 1930s when we did have a social and economic crisis, provinces did not step up to the bat on a host of social issues, including healthcare. And it really wasn't until the war and right after the war where governments started to talk about whether or not there should be some kind of public engagement, some kind of public intervention in our healthcare system. Again, this tended to come from the federal government, though it was stymied in its attempts to do so because of jurisdictional issues, right? The federal government couldn't get out there and build a national health insurance program because it was considered to be a provincial initiative. And it was one province in particular who decided to actually run with that initiative, and that was the province of Saskatchewan. And what's interesting about the province of Saskatchewan in 1946 is that it's the most rural and the poorest province in Canada, and yet it finds a way to actually engage its residents, its citizens, in this new world of publicly funded insurance. What the Saskatchewan government does when it comes to power after 1944 is that it decides to set up a system of hospital insurance. And the reason that it chose hospital insurance was twofold. One is that hospital costs were the largest costs associated with care at that time. And second, by targeting hospitals, they didn't have to deal with a very powerful interest group lobby, which were the physicians. And so hospital insurance in Saskatchewan became really the cornerstone or the basis of what we know today as publicly funded insurance in Canada. In 1957, the federal government set up a cost-sharing program that, in effect, allowed other provinces to take advantage of federal money to set up their own hospital insurance programs. And so by the end of 1961, Quebec being the last province to join into this cost-sharing program after the Lesage Liberals defeat the Union Nationale in 1960, all the provinces in Canada have such a hospital insurance system. Of course, that's only part of the equation, and certainly for Tommy Douglas, who had been the premier at the time of hospital insurance, the real test was going to be the next part of it, which was medical insurance. And I just want to point out to you that when medical insurance was being debated and, in fact, implemented in the province of Saskatchewan, this led to a huge political crisis. So, you know, we tend to think that the system we have was always there. It wasn't always there, and there was a huge political battle surrounding the implementation of medical insurance, including a three-week-long strike by Saskatchewan physicians. So all of this came about as in terms of political struggle, right? Didn't just fall from the sky. That model was then diffused across Canada after the Hall Commission reported in 1964, and the Liberal government, this is Lester Pearson's Liberal government, voted in another cost-sharing program for medical insurance. So by 1972, all of the provinces and all of the territories now had in place both hospital and medical insurance programs that were being cost-shared, right? They were in which the federal government was sharing in the cost that it took. The reason I'm putting a lot of emphasis on cost sharing is that the rules of the game started to change almost immediately. And so by the end of the 70s, the federal government realized that this open-ended kind of cost sharing was not making much fiscal sense, either for the federal government, which was having to pay half of 50 cents on the dollar of what provinces spent, but also because it didn't have a built-in mechanism for cost control. And so what the federal government did is that it changed the funding rules of the game in 1977 and suggested that the provinces now would get a block grant from which they would have to fund both healthcare and, interestingly enough, given the situation in Quebec today, post-secondary education. And in effect, because of that, provinces started to look for cost-cutting measures, some of which people thought were against the spirit of a universal healthcare system. And one of the people who thought that, very interestingly enough, is someone who you know or you've heard of, is Monique Bégin. And one of Monique Bégin's, contributions to Canada is that she was the Minister of Health that led to the Canada Health Act. And the reason that the Canada Health Act was put into place was, in effect, to consolidate hospital and medical insurance into one federal statute and to say that now, if provinces wanted federal money, there were certain rules that they had to follow. That is to say, their own healthcare systems had to abide by five principles. And these, of course, are the very well-known principles of the Canada Health Act. Quebec's healthcare system, in fact, all of the provincial healthcare systems are supposed to respect, in theory and in practice, these five principles, that the healthcare system in the provinces will be publicly or have public administration, since we're talking about taxpayer money, that they will be comprehensive, that is to say, cover all medically necessary services, that they will be universal, so that it covers 100% of legal residents in a province, that they're portable, right? And many of my students have had problems with this portability, but the idea is that no matter where you go in Canada, your coverage follows you, and most importantly, that the services will be offered on the basis of equal terms and conditions, which basically means, in practice, that need should trump the ability to pay. And this is the equal access provision of the Canada Health Act, which was put into place directly to counteract some of the things that the provinces were doing, including user fees and including allowing doctors to extra bill their patients. Both of those measures became, in fact, not tenable under the terms of the Canada Health Act after 1984, and several provinces did have to change their laws. The other game changer is, of course, the Canada Health and Social Transfer, which, again, changed the way that we funded healthcare in Canada and severely curtailed the amount of money that the federal government was prepared to send to the provinces for a whole host of social programs, and so provinces had to come back and find ways to be able to deal with this. And then we engaged in what Canada's really good at, chopping down forests, right? This is the pre-internet era, chopping down forests and wasting a lot of paper by setting up commissions. I shouldn't say we waste, because Dr. Bergman was part of one of these commissions here in Quebec, which had a big impact on primary care reform, later primary care reform. But certainly there were a series of healthcare commissions across the provinces, including three big federal ones, the 1997 National Forum on Health, the Romano Report, and the Kirby Report. So this was the era of mega commissions. What should we do about our healthcare system? So the question and the conversations that we've been having about sustainability started quite a while ago. That led to another era, an era of what I call mega investment, which is how the federal government decided to reinvest in healthcare through a number of different accords in which the federal government set the rules, right, about the money, and the most famous of which is the 2004 10-year plan to strengthen healthcare. There's former Prime Minister Paul Martin trying to look happy as he's freezing at a Grey Cup game with former Manitoba Premier Gary Doer. But the upshot is, for the first time in Canadian history, we had a multi-year funding process in which funds were automatically going to be increased by 6% per year. This is a huge, so for those of us, like I know it's kind of boring, but for those of us who are really into fiscal federalism, this is in fact a huge deal and had a big impact on the amount of money that was available to provinces for healthcare, and also that it was money they could count on over 10 years. Today, of course, we're at the end of that 10-year cycle, which will end in 2014. So where are we there? Here are some of the facts. I'm going to go through them very quickly. First of all, we spend a lot of money on healthcare. We spend a lot of money relative to other countries. We're a big spender in the OECD. The only country we don't spend a lot of money relative to is the United States. So we spend a lot of money on healthcare. Our healthcare system is, in fact, a very expensive part of our political real estate. We have all kinds of scenarios that tell us that if we don't start controlling healthcare costs, that it will basically be like the dog who ate Christmas and swipe everything in its past. This is a debate between demographers, economists, and sociologists about whether or not this will actually happen. But certainly we know that the spending is on an uptick. We also know that provinces depend on the federal government for these transfers, so that when you hear provinces talking about how they need more money from the federal government, they are talking about the kinds of transfers. This is not equalization. These were actual transfers, cash transfers on per capita basis that they need to be able to fund healthcare systems. And we also know that some provinces are thinking about how to change the whole funding structure. And one of the most interesting, in fact, is here in Quebec. 2 years ago, our Quebec government, in fact, the Minister of Finance, Raymond Bachand, introduced two measures. One was going to be a healthcare deductible, which was basically a user fee, which he decided not to implement. And the other is a health contribution or premium that you're all paying, thank goodness, which is, in effect, considered to be a bit of a boost in terms of healthcare revenues, but obviously probably not enough to make up any shortfalls in terms of the increase in costs. We also have in the present day, we have to think about things like new actors in healthcare politics. So when Tommy Douglas was thinking about healthcare and hospital and medical insurance in Saskatchewan, he may have been thinking about the Constitution, but he wasn't thinking about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And today, any health policy analyst has to think about the courts, in particular after two landmark cases, Auton versus British Columbia, which suggested that new services, such as, in this case, services for autistic children, did not have to come under that basket of insured services in British Columbia. And the one you're probably more familiar with, which is Shaoli versus Quebec, in which the restrictions or prohibitions on private insurance for publicly insured services was, in effect, upended by the Supreme Court of Canada. And that, of course, is Dr. Shaoli in that photo. Where are we headed? Here are some of the challenges, and I know that Dr. Bergman is going to go over them as well. We have demographic challenges. We have challenges that come from the high cost of innovation. We have challenges in our health and human resources, which is not only about how many doctors we have, but about where the doctors live and practice and what they do, what kind of doctors they are. And we have something that's really interesting, which is a paradox for many people who study public opinion, is that we have rising expectations, right? People have rising expectations about what the healthcare system can do for them, for their families, and yet decreasing confidence. That's overlaid by, in fact, when you talk to people through when you could still get StatsCan surveys, that people who have access to healthcare services are actually quite happy with the services they receive, but when you ask people about the future sustainability of the system, there is a lot of unease. So that's a paradox that public opinion scholars have been trying to untangle in the Canadian context. There's also the question of politics, and I come back to it because it's not just politics in general, it's also partisan politics. The saliency, that is to say, the fact that healthcare still matters during an election campaign, that people actually base their political decisions in part on where they think a party sits or stands on the healthcare issue, means that it's still politically a very charged issue, not just here in the province of Quebec, but really across the country. And the question to ask is, are political parties, do they actually have a policy wedge on this issue? So as we go into 2015, for example, for the federal government, are we going to see a huge difference of opinion between the Conservatives and the NDP and the Liberal Party, if it still exists by then? We also want to think about what the government is doing in terms of some of its rhetoric and its actions. What's interesting here is that we have a federal government that, in effect, does not want to make healthcare users pay, right, by saying that we don't want to balance our budget on the back of the healthcare system and that we support the Canada Health Act. And yet, at the same time, Mr. Flaherty is now suggesting that the way that we can look at the future after 2014 in terms of federal money for the provinces is that we're going to have to decrease the amount of money to have it meet inflation, right, or the growth of inflation, and also on a purely per capita basis. And finally, there's federalism. Federalism is a huge institutional issue in Canadian politics generally, and it is the crucial factor in predicting healthcare futures, both in terms of that fiscal federalism that I just mentioned, but also in terms of whether or not we're going to have any drama around the Canada Health Act and around the fact that some provinces may be doing things that either citizens or the federal government, that's sure in the latter case, think contravenes the spirit of that law. We also know that the Quebec budget has now changed the nature of the game for healthcare in Quebec. By looking, I mean, it's not a complete parallel, but by looking at what happened in terms of the student protests, I often ask myself, wow, what about if they did something like that in healthcare and all the users went on the street, all the clients went out on the street, everyone left the hospital rooms and went on into the street, what would happen then? But, you know, this is a question we may ask rhetorically, but we may be there in a budget or two here in Quebec. Finally, just to end, we need to think about how to determine needs and manage expectations. And I think, again, this is where my colleagues in the healthcare world, the actual practitioners, need to also come and be part of this conversation. It's not just about, you know, how much money we spend in healthcare and who should decide what the money does and who should get the money, but why do we need this money? Where should it actually be targeted? And what, at the end of the day, do we want the healthcare system to accomplish? What are the objectives here? Is it better health? I don't see any kind of interest on the part of politicians for health outcomes. They're always at the beginning of the stage and not at the end. So why don't we hear more about what we want to accomplish in our healthcare system if we want to meet those objectives? So my I guess, parting shot would be to you that we need to focus more on outputs. What is it what we want at the end of the healthcare system, not the money that we're putting into it, but what we want to get with the money and the reforms in terms of organization. Some of the things that have to do with access to care, integration and continuity. We need to think about health inequalities because there will be more health inequalities if we start changing the way we fund healthcare in Canada. We need to have a better understanding of why we're in the healthy situation or not that we're in. This is not a debate from today. This is a debate from decades-old debate. And, of course, some incentive structures that we can build in so that both organizations and practitioners have some sense of where they're going in our healthcare system. And finally, how about some lessons from Barack Obama? He went through a huge political cost in terms of the healthcare reforms that he brought into place in the United States. Here are the two lessons that I think we can draw from the American experience. One is that this is a polarizing issue. The biggest prediction of whether somebody likes Canada or not in the United States in terms of healthcare is whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, right? So this is a hugely divisive ideological issue in the United States, and we may be going down that road in Canada as well. And finally, that there is path dependency at work. So there is a fact, there is a way you can contain change in the United States, but at the same time, change does happen. So when we think about Canada, we think, oh, you know, nothing's going to change. We have to go down this road. Politically speaking, anything can happen. Thanks very much.
Hello. As you can see from Antonio's presentation, healthcare systems are very complex, extremely complex animals. I don't think I can do as good a synthesis as Antonio did on what I'm going to try to say to you. I'm going to try and the title is trying, and I underline trying to make sense of our healthcare system, but I'm going to particularly talk about primary care reform, because I think that's one of the key elements to a successful healthcare system. But I can't stop myself from making a comment on Antonio's presentation. Is when we talk about healthcare and expenses, we always talk about the expenses as if it's going down a toilet into a sewer and out the drain. But when you think of it, our healthcare system is a major high-tech industry and is an important part of our economy. So we all agree to invest in education. Some people say more or less. We all agree to invest in industry. The government gives millions and millions of dollars to all sorts of industrial giants and small industries, et cetera, yet we never recognize that the budget, healthcare budget, is really a very important part of a very high-tech industry. Think of all the research that is generated that comes out of that. And Pittsburgh, several years ago, the city of Pittsburgh, developed its strategic plan around its healthcare industry in terms of attracting other industries, et cetera. Anyway, it's something to think about because it's always a very one-way debate that we're sort of putting money down the drain. So this is an interesting quotation. An evolutionary biologist presented work on long-lived flies, and a demographer asked, what do the old flies look like? Oh, their wings fall off. Well, the policies and therapies that increase humans' length of life but entail profound disability, and this, I would need two pointers, actually. This lady here would be unacceptable to human society. So this lady has severe Parkinson's disease and dementia. This young gentleman at the age of 83 when this picture was taken, this was 6 months after quadruple, I don't know how many bypass things, it's quadruples, how do you say five vessel bypass, six vessel, but he had four or five vessel bypass surgery. This is 6 months after his surgery, and he, as you can see, he's very proud of himself, his swimming and his medals. And it's sort of the two faces of aging in a certain way. Now, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of old, and particularly old, and I suppose we'll soon be going to old. And this is a good thing. You know, I keep hearing about the tsunami, the great tsunami, the aging population, the crisis of the aging population, but isn't this what we wanted? We wanted to be well taken care of. We wanted to increase our life expectancy. We wanted to live better, and there are studies that show that not only we're living longer, but we're living better longer. But at the same time, there's a tremendous increase in the prevalence of chronic disease. As you can see, and by the way, you're going to have to read the slides. I'm not going to read every line in the slide, so you have to work as well. So there's an increase in the prevalence of chronic disease, and now there's a consensus that chronic disease is the main driver of morbidity, illness, mortality, death, healthcare utilization, healthcare costs. So that's really become the name of the game in terms of the healthcare system. Much more than, you know, cardiac transplants and other of the very high tech, which are extremely important. But what's really driving utilization and cost in our healthcare system is chronic disease. And by the way, it's a global challenge. I said the global challenge, because it's a challenge also for almost every developing country in the world. China, which is in the countryside is a developing country, and in the cities it's a developed country, but China is struggling with an aging population, and so is India, and so are most of the countries of Latin America. And what's happening, and Morty's going to time me, so I tend to get off on these little stories, but what's happening is the developing countries are aging at a much more rapid rate. So France, for example, took 300 or 400 years to go from 5% over 65 to 25%. Mexico is going to do it in 60 years. So our countries develop first and age first. The developing countries are aging and developing at the same time, and that's a tremendous challenge. So we see this shift from the acute to chronic disease. We also see the shift in the good old days. You went to one place, they took care of you or not, and that was it. Now we go from institutions, really, to networks of care, from single sites to many sites, from a single professional, generally a physician, to many healthcare teams of healthcare professionals. And as Antonio pointed out, expectation, knowledge, and involvement of patients and families have increased considerably. Somebody compared it to the, you know, 30-minute pizza delivery, or you get it free. You know, we all buy from that same place and hope they bring it at 31 minutes and not at 30 minutes. But our expectations is we need it now and we need it quickly, and there's more knowledge, and this is positive. This is positive. So healthcare has become much more complex. Everything is much more interdependent. There's a lot more uncertainty. In spite of how our knowledge has increased, there's still a lot of uncertainty. And as Antonio pointed out, increasing preoccupation with cost and performance leading to increased government intervention, control, and reform, and leading often to continuous, maybe, change that is happening too often and not being able to go through the reforms that have been proposed rather than going from reform to reform. So who are the older people? So this is you know this guy. So he's not really old here, but this is a younger Paul Newman, and this is a much older Paul Newman. So who are the older people? Well, that's interesting also, because the older people are very heterogeneous. Okay, if you took a group of 35-year-olds, are there any 35-year-olds here? There's a few. You're all about the same. I hate to tell you that. You're closer to each other than if you took a group of 75 or 80-year-olds who are very, very different. So on this slide, it's a small study of about 50 people, and we replicate another study, 70 years older, who had cancer. So there are people who are sick. But as you can see, that only a small percentage, this group over here, only a relatively small percentage, had real, what we call in our geriatric lingo, activities of daily living, disabilities that needed help. This was needed a little bit of help. But all this 54%, were completely independent. So, in fact, we need to understand the heterogeneity and complexity of older persons, from the very healthy older persons who need good primary medical care. I'm not going to go through this in detail, to those who are starting to become frail, those who develop what we call disability or who need help, and then the more very complex older persons who have complex medical problems and need help in daily care and need complex systems of care, and finally, end-of-life care, and I'm not going to have time to talk about that either. So there's a real, on the one hand, and here's the good news, there's a potential for promotion and prevention, promoting healthy aging, and at least delaying the onset of frailty and disability. I was at a meeting on Alzheimer's disease last week or two weeks ago in Europe, and there was a very fascinating result of a study that hasn't been published yet, but which suggests that the incidence, that cases of new Alzheimer's disease, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease, is going down. And that's terrific news. If you just go down quickly enough for all of us here. It's going down because why? Because we've done things like on health promotion in terms of cardiovascular, because what drives Alzheimer's disease is vascular in many cases. So, you know, we're eating better, plus we're picking up the chronic diseases earlier in terms of diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol, etc. So that's very interesting that there can be an effect, and I hope this will be published soon and we can get a better understanding. At the same time, as I suggested with my swimmer, the swimmer, we're doing increasingly complex medical and surgical interventions on older and older people. And that's a good thing as well, because this gentleman of 82 or 83 years old, when that surgery was done, I mean, without this surgery, he would have been a cripple and probably would have died several years later and not very happy. Think of all the cataract surgery. Think of the hip replacement, the gentleman who's who is one of the parking lots where I park, is having one of his ankles replaced. And think of all the hopefully appropriate interventions we do with older people, and which leads to, I think, better quality of life and not only living longer but better quality of life. But yet our healthcare systems are still poorly adapted to management of chronic disease, frailty, and dependency, and to the complexity of treating chronic diseases and frail older people, because it's very complicated. Because the frail older people need a very complex combination of health and social services. If we look at this slide, which shows the complexity of older persons. So this is an older gentleman that I took his picture in a park in Tokyo, and nobody told this gentleman that smoking was not good, that it would reduce his life expectancy terribly, and so he's having a nice walk in the park and smoking a cigarette. I'm not suggesting we should all start walking. Well, we should walk in the park and not necessarily all smoke cigarettes. I like to derive lessons from my mentors. And Wayne Gretzky is one of my mentors because he said something very interesting. He said, "I skate where the puck will be." And that's very interesting. So this is this great sense of anticipation by athletes. He's not skating where the puck is, because if he skates where the puck is going to be somewhere else. So he's able to anticipate and skate where the puck will be. And unfortunately, many times in our healthcare system, we tend to skate where the puck is, and by the time we get there, the puck's not there anymore. So what do I mean by that? Let's see if this analogy holds the cold. There's an international consensus now, that primary care, and this is what I'm going to talk about mainly, that primary care is the foundation of modern, sustainable healthcare systems. And so I had the honor to be a member of the Clare Commission, which Antonio mentioned, and my baby on that commission was the proposal to reform primary medical care with the creation of the Groupe de Médecine de Famille, the family medicine groups that you might know about. And I'm just going to talk about this key issue of reform of primary care and why it's such a key issue. And I think we're all understanding it now because of the difficulty we all have in finding a primary care physician. Right? So I want to talk about that because this is probably now the most important piece of our system to fix. And I should also point out that there are no simple answers. There are no simple answers anywhere. Every healthcare system is struggling with these same issues. There are no simple answers to these problems, and there's no simple answers in terms of organization, no simple answer in terms of finance. I suspect medical care is expensive, and we just have to figure that out. But if we accept, as I said, that it's partly an investment, I think we'd feel better about it. So what about primary care? We all remember Dr. Welby, right? This is sort of the epitome of primary care. He knew all his patients. He'd visit them at home. He'd go in and he'd sit down and have tea with them, you know, and chat with them for an hour and a half or so, and then leave, go on to his next patient. We all remember when we were younger that we had doctors like that. I remember we had a pediatrician, Dr. Gavzi, who would come to our house, who would literally come to our house when we were sick. That was a wonderful relationship that we had. Now, what we have to understand about Dr. Welby, if you remember, was that we kept seeing the same five patients, right? So, but those days, unfortunately, are over. Unfortunately, are over. The healthcare system is too complex now to have this type of simple relationship, and it wouldn't work. It would not work anymore. This is another type of primary care where we won't touch the patients anymore. So you see they have these big gloves and test tubes, and this is sort of the promise of personalized medicine. So we'll take a drop of blood or another part of your body, and we'll squish it into something, and then we'll tell you your genome and your whole genetic makeup. We'll tell you what you ate yesterday, who you're going to eat with tomorrow, and what's going to happen to you. And we won't even have to touch you anymore. In fact, you don't even have to come in. So the wife of one of the Googles has a company. You can send your saliva, and there's another part of your body, I forget which one, and they'll send you back your whole genetic makeup, and it's not that expensive. It's not that accurate either, and there are a lot of problems with it, but it's not. But both these versions are not really acceptable to the modern healthcare system. So what is this primary medical reform that's going on? In Quebec, it's called the Groupe de Médecine de Famille, or Family Medicine Group. In Ontario, Family Health Team. The College of Family Physicians calls it the Medical Home. They may or may not be in the same building, but basically it's a group of physicians. So if the Family Medicine Group that I know well, it's a group of 4 to 10 physicians, maybe a bit more, an interdisciplinary practice. So they work with nurse clinicians who are part of this practice that they have. They have the notion of being responsible for continuity of care within a rostered population. So they have a specific population. Now, part of this is theoretical, part of this will happen, part of this has not happened yet, but this is evolution. And so a rostered population, meaning they have a panel, they have a 1,500 patients in their list. It's not that formal in Quebec yet. And so they can study this population and get to know this population. So one group, the Médecine de Famille, one family medicine group, may have more diabetes, may have more young people, may have more old people, etc. And so this notion of population responsibility, evolving remuneration, where we're going to move away from fee-for-service and move toward a type of incentive and payment that will stimulate this type of continuity of care, infrastructure for IT, and evolving integration of other healthcare professionals. This is, I don't know, how many of you know about the family medicine groups? How many are part of, how many goes to a physician or are part of a family medicine group? Okay, there's a few. And there's more than a few. And this is going to go up. This is going to go up continually over the next while. And I would predict that we're moving away from Claude Castonguay and the Castonguay Commission. Their vision was all the doctors would work in CLSCs, and that would be the group practice, and the CLSCs would be the unit of integration. I suspect now we're going to move toward these family medicine groups being the unit of integration with their population, their interdisciplinary team working together. So I had the honor of chairing this task force to propose an Alzheimer plan for Quebec. I won't go through all of it, but just to say two very important objectives. One is rapid access to assessment and management. So somebody with a memory problem at the present time does not have rapid access in general. And the second, innovative ways to negotiate services. And so the idea of developing a lasting relationship between the person with Alzheimer's disease and their family and a professional assigned to the patient as soon as a diagnosis is made. This does not exist at the present time. This does not exist at the present time. So basically what we propose and what the government is going to implement is developing within these family medicine groups a chronic care collaborative practice model. And so having the doctor and the nurse clinician work together with the patient and the caregiver, and this nurse clinician becoming the nurse navigator, infirmier pivot. You might have heard that word if any of you have had cancer, unfortunately, or had a family with cancer. That's a nurse pivot. I know you know that when you leave the office of the physician, and even as a physician, when I leave the office of a physician, I try to stay away from them, but sometimes you can. That's when you think of all your questions, right? It's the moment you leave that office and you close the door, that's all the questions start, and it's too late. Try and phone back that physician. It's not that he's sitting around, you know, on the beach somewhere. So this nurse clinician is somebody, this nurse pivot, the infirmier pivot, is somebody who's available and could be a trusted clinician working with his primary care physician with the family. So the good news is, because, you know, we have a sense of lack of confidence, and it's true. It's true that Antonio said. Unfortunately, we have a lack of confidence, and unfortunately, there's lots of people these days out on the streets who have a lack of confidence, and that's too bad. But there are some things that seem to be moving in the right direction. So, you know, we tabled this report in May 2009. There were three ministers who publicly received the report. They were ecstatic about the report. They were ecstatic about me, et cetera, et cetera. And then nothing happened for 2 years. But I've learned to be patient over time. And then it took time, but now it's starting to develop. So the idea of there's a ministerial decision with budget, and there's going to be 15 to 20 demonstration projects across Quebec with the idea of rolling this out and generalizing it to the healthcare system. So another one of my mentors, of course, is Yogi Berra. The future ain't what it used to be. So in conclusion, and you'll see my conclusion is not my last slide. So in conclusion, aging is a major challenge for our society and health and social system. There are no easy answers. There's a consensus around primary medical care. Implementation still has been elusive, but things are moving in the right direction. There's also the elusive challenge that I haven't talked about of integrating health and social services with primary medical care, and that'll be for another session if Mira wants to invite me back. But there are positive signs. There are positive signs that the Quebec Ministry of Health wants to invest in primary care, that the research funding bodies want to invest in research in primary care, and our Faculty of Medicine and our Dean David Eidelman has indicated to some of you might have seen the article in Le Devoir on Saturday, has made really the development of family medicine an important academic priority. The real question, at what point will the government say, will the Ministry of Health say, this is a real priority and we're going to invest in this priority and make it happen? About a month or two ago, there was an article in La Presse which summarized all the huge construction projects in the university hospitals in Montreal. The MUHC, the CHUM, the Jewish General, Maisonneuve Rosemont, et cetera, et cetera, St. Mary's, and everything is necessary. All this is necessary. We can't take away money from good special care, specialty care. But I would say to the minister, just give me 25% of what you're putting in there. And take 25% of all the political energy and the political will that was put to developing these amazing hospital projects and put it into saying we're going to solve the primary care issue. And we would do it. We would do it within 5 years. So there's an issue of political will and investment. So George Burns, on his 95th birthday, said, he did this monologue, this amazing monologue, and doing a monologue takes a lot of coordination, cognitive, physical, etc., with his cigar, like my Japanese friend. And he said, I feel today like I felt when I was 20 years old. And he paused and then said, which shows you how pathetic I was at 20 years old. So UB Blake said, if I had known how long I was going to live, I would have taken better care of myself. So people usually ask me, how can we age better? So there's a whole series of things that we need to do as a society, as individuals. There's a thing called unhealthy behaviors, which I hate the word unhealthy behaviors, because it's as if there's something we're doing that's our fault. And I think it's a term that's extremely negative. And it's generally wrong because generally people who don't have good nutrition, good exercise habits, etc., generally are those in the lower socioeconomic status and lower education. So we have to be careful about terms. But there's all sorts of things that we need to do as a society in terms of education, socioeconomic status, improved working conditions, all these issues of doing the right thing, right? Exercise, nutrition, normal body mass index, don't smoke, et cetera, lead to better things. And we're seeing it with this Alzheimer's study, which I find very, very interesting. Salt intake, et cetera, et cetera. Then I put up red wine. Now, there's a very interesting result from population. Do I have 2 minutes for red wine? There's very interesting results from population studies that shows that no alcohol and too much alcohol is not good for you. So the real question is, how much alcohol is good for you. So I'm inviting you to join me in a study that I'm doing, going around the world with red wine, seeing what is the appropriate amount of red wine that is good for me, and insert which and from which region of the world, and is adding cheese good or not. And finally, you know, people have been saying, well, healthcare is not important to improving health of the population. That's not true. It's one of the pieces that's important in improving health of the population. As I talked about, the treating of chronic diseases, joint replacement, cataract surgery, etc. So, if all this doesn't work, what else can we do? Well, this is another advice I have for you. Whoop it up until you're 99, and then be very, very careful. And finally, choose your parents very, very carefully. Thank you very much.
I really want to thank both speakers for excellent presentations, a lot of provoking questions that they've asked. I think two items that are very encouraging is, one, the fact that it looks promising with respect to primary health care, and I think that's a good indication. And the second is a question I'm going to ask first, is where do we sign up for the red wine experiment, which other people will ask. We now have the opportunity to ask both presenters questions. You can direct it to one, but I'm certain, knowing both Antonia and Howard, they may each sort of want to respond to the question. So I know there are microphones some places. I can't see with the light in my eyes. Mira, where are the microphones?
There
should be cordless. Good, here. Okay, so you guys will handle them? Okay, please. Nancy? Wait a second. They're going to bring you a cordless microphone because it's being broadcast live, so they want to pick up your voice. Yeah. Sure, please.
Thank you. It was a very enlightening presentation. So one of the challenges I have is two comments, is that how do we enlighten the people around here to the students who are on the street mobilizing? And I feel a lot of people here need the services. I have clients and friends that have parents with Alzheimer's. The children don't visit. You know, we have societal issues as well. Like in my day, it was not a question that I went to take care of my grandparent, or I visited, or I did shopping. I have people here from the States that are, they have no friends, they have no relatives. So I think, and the last comment was an occupational therapist said, you know, why can't you just give me a parking permit so that I can park in front of the house and not park 2 miles away and carry, you know, the adaptive toilet. So I don't think we have the proper tools to inform the government, let's say, of what we can do that's low cost and can help us make things better on a day-to-day basis, because I think it's going to take maybe 5-10 years to get the changes going. So it's kind of for both of you. Thanks.
I think you have agreement there.
No, but do you have any tools? Like, is it a Facebook page? Is it a Twitter account? Do you call your MP? Do you suggest solutions? Because we don't want to be inactive. It just, every day it gets harder.
Call one of those three student leaders, though. Well, they're amazingly articulate, and it's almost not a joke because you know, you raised this question of will this become an issue for the population, and will this become a political issue? You remember several years ago, Mulroney said he was going to, he's going to cut the pensions. Actually, Harper's getting away with it now. But there were all sorts of demonstrations and started. So if it becomes a political issue, then I think it's the issue of political action around that. In terms of what are the solutions, I think there are all sorts of solutions. We need research. There's health services research that's being done. We know there are certain effective ways of organizing services, of how budgets are distributed, of how developing responsibilities. So the different solutions are out there. It's how you put it together in a coherent system of care.
Yeah, and I would suggest two things. I mean, one is this idea of having more of a coordinated approach. that health care and good health is not just about the Ministry of Health, right? It's about the Ministry of Transport. It's about municipal bylaws. This is something we tend to forget. You know, we tend to isolate health care as being out there. We used to have a, they used to put, you know, health care used to be part of something larger. And I think that that's what we have to go back to. We've taken it out and put it in a silo. It's part of something that's larger about our lives. And I think we have to force governments to do it, to think about it in a larger way. And the second thing is, we do have a lot of research, but the way that that research gets translated into policy, not so clear.
Perhaps another, just a quick comment is the way our healthcare system is organized, as in many countries, nobody really trusts anybody. So what we have is sort of a command and control system. And so the Ministry of Health, really, we used to have regional boards, which had some sort of independence. Now we have agences and less independence and more control. So the ministry doesn't control anybody, doesn't trust anybody below them, and they send people who are bean counters to watch everything. The Treasury Board doesn't trust the Ministry of Health, and so they're counting there, and et cetera, et cetera. And so what we have is everybody learns that you say the right things to the person above you, and that's not very good for innovation. Rather than developing some sort of in a system based on solidarity, in a system, a public system of care, developing innovative systems which are more grassroots. So local groups, local organizations can make decisions about how they're going to realize the healthcare reforms based on a certain number of indicators, based on a certain number of orientations and objectives. But how it's done, you know, your suggestion may be different from one place to another. The other thing we tend to do is one size fits all. So we know that Montreal, even downtown Montreal, is not the same as outside the downtown. Montreal is not the same as Sherbrooke. Sherbrooke's not the same as Gaspé, etc.
I was very intrigued with, Doctor, I was very intrigued with your discussion of cancer. It made me think, how do I tell when I have the first stages of cancer before it's fatal? How do I know it? Or what tests do I take? Or what do I ask my doctor?
I'm not sure this is an appropriate time to answer that type of question. I don't know how I would answer it, and I, you know, that's such a very, very complex question. There are certain cancers we do screening for, and which is there are very complex issues around that. You might have seen articles on screening for prostate cancer with PSA, which has become very controversial, and American organizations have said no. So it's a very complex clinical question. I think if I could find the answer, I'd probably get the Nobel Prize.
Hi. I have two little issues, and I'm wondering if they're right or not. Number one, is it true that Medicare only costs one-fifth of actual public care, so to speak, or private care, as they call it in the States? Because that's what I have heard. So where's the government's argument if that's true?
I'm not sure what you mean by one-fifth, but certainly we know that the 70% of total health care costs in Canada are actually flow through the public system. 30% do not. That 30% that does not flow through the public system is rising in relative cost more rapidly than the public portion.
Yeah, okay. And the second issue for me is how do we legislate lifestyle? That is a big factor in our cost. That's a hard one.
I think we go back to what Dr. Bergman said, that it's not just about lifestyle, it's not about unhealthy behaviors as such, but it's also about some of the determinants that lead to these unhealthy behaviors.
Okay.
Thanks. You mentioned that there should be incentives for better outcomes. Would you care to elaborate on that a little bit?
It means that when we, in political terms, when we talk about funding for healthcare, we're talking about how much provinces need to pay doctors, need to be able to run hospitals efficiently. My question is, why can't we start by what we want to see at the end, right? So we want to spend so much money in healthcare so that our population is this much healthier, so that our healthcare outcomes are this much better. We don't have that conversation. When we are coming up to this anniversary of 10 years for the health accord, how are we going to judge what happened to that money? I agree with Dr. Bergman that it's not all just costs. A lot of it is investment. But at the same time, how are we going to know whether that money, that reinvestment in money was a success or not? Well, my question, just as a humble taxpayer, would be, well, what's happened to health outcomes? Are we healthier? Have we done things better? And I don't think there's any province in Canada that is prepared to give us the spreadsheet on that.
Is it practical for hospitals to compete with each other just as people in private industry do? In other words, outcomes from each hospital determine how much money they get?
I was referring more to population, not to those kinds of outcomes. Population
health. I mean, that's an interesting question around incentives for hospitals and outcomes. And there are certain hospitals that are starting to publish their numbers, et cetera. I don't know how people are going to make sense of them, but it's also very complex. It's not as simple as you think, because let's say hospitals start publishing their rate of success or complication rate around such and such a surgery. Well, in the States, what happens sometimes is the hospitals are starting to get into trouble. They'll say, okay, I'm not going to operate on complicated cases anymore because I'm going to look better. Now, there's ways of finding the numbers, but it's a complicated issue. We developed a project in about 12, 13 years ago called SIPA, Système d'intégré pour personnes âgées, where the idea was that we would give to a local organization the pot of money, okay? And then this local group, the details aren't important for the moment, this local group would then be responsible for the population that it serves, and then would be responsible also for paying for their health care wherever that health care was delivered. At the present time, if our home care services are following somebody, Madame Pilon, and she goes into the emergency, they're good people, they don't want it to happen, but it's no skin off their back, and in fact, they may be happy because now she's out of their hair and out of their budget. And the hospital is the same thing, if I can get somebody out of my hospital quickly. So the idea was, if you have this pot of money and I'm responsible for paying wherever it happens, maybe I can use it in different ways to keep people out of hospital, for example. So that's one way of judging. The second way of judging is on the quality of care, satisfaction, the health outcomes. Sometimes we can't, in certain categories of people, we can't improve health outcomes, but we can improve satisfaction, we can improve access to care, etc. So there are different ways of getting at this issue of incentives.
Hi, thank you. One of the basic issues that you've raised today, Antonio, you raised the issue of accessibility, and Dr. Bergman, you raised the issue and focused and highlighted primary care. What do you recommend? I know the future holds maybe promise in terms of getting everybody that accessibility in primary care. But today I have two sisters and two kids who are almost graduating from their pediatrician's office needing a GP. What do you recommend for this crisis now, today? How do you go about finding a GP? How do you go about getting into the primary care treatment stream?
There's no simple answer. If I had it, you'd all run out and go to the same doctor, right? You know, the regionally agence has set up, and all the agences have set up some sort of system where you put your name on a list, etc. I don't really have an answer for that, unfortunately. The answer is not, unfortunately, there's not going to be a very short-term, quick answer to that. You know, because if I give you the name of somebody who's taking on new patients, they're all going to rush there, and that's going to be blocked up. The answer is going to be very strong measures. Now, one of the measures, the government is saying we're now moving to 50-50%. 50% of all residents need to be in family medicine versus 50% in specialty, and this is a major change that's happening progressively. So we're going to be putting out more family physicians. But we also have a context where they want to do general family medicine, not run off to do emergency room work, because there's incentives now we created for doctors when they graduate, do emergency room work. Well, if we create those incentives, we're creating incentives moving away from general family medicine. We have situations now where these family medicine groups, where nurses working together with doctors can take on a greater number of patients and follow a greater number of patients. So there's a whole series of things that need to be done. In the end, you know, the MUHC was a rather tame evolution compared to the SHUM. You know, I don't know how many sites they went through. And the political struggles even at, you know, between Charest and Couillard. And again, when I look at that, I said, geez, give me 25% of the budget, what I said before, 25% of the political will and determination to make these things happen, and we could make it happen. We could make it happen, and we can solve that problem, I think, within three to five years. But not everybody agrees about this. I mean, after the Clare Commission, I had people who criticized me severely because we said, you know, you forgot about our hospitals. You just talked about primary care. So there's a whole tension around that, but I think it's in the end it's political will and investment that's going to make a change.
I would be a little bit more kind of, because I'm not a physician, I can say what I like. I think the problem is that we have a healthcare system in the Canadian provinces that's not based on coherent access. And it's a dispersed model, right? You can access healthcare from so many points that it, in some cases it makes no sense. In countries where you have specific access points into the healthcare system, you have much stronger primary care as a foundation, as Dr. Bergman says. And there are some American lessons from not-for-profit HMOs, from the Kaiser model, the idea of having a medical home. All of those things are not science fiction, and they could be done, but the incentive structures will change for physicians, and fee-for-service may also be part of that change. We can't hear you.
Sorry about that. I'd like to know what your opinions are about public-private partnerships in Quebec.
It's a very charged question in Quebec and in other places. My personal opinion that the basic access to our healthcare system has to be public. Now, how this and the financing of our healthcare system has to basically to be public. And I think there's enough data to show that that generally is the most efficient way of doing things. Does that mean everything has to be delivered by a strictly public part of the system? That's another thing. And I think there's where we have an opportunity to develop a more varied way of delivering healthcare and utilizing all the important elements of our society, which are both public, private, and also the non-for-profit organizations. And we see that. So in our Alzheimer's plan that we proposed, we said we need to bring together in a synergistic way all the key actors, and some of the key actors are in the private system. But the planning and the ultimate decisions have to be made by the public system of care. So that's my personal view. The other view is, you know, where's the money coming from? I don't know. You know, if the money comes from my right pocket or my left pocket, you know, in the form of taxes, of my right pocket, or in the form of a private insurance or important private, it's still coming out of my pocket. So we're still paying the money out of it. So that doesn't, for me, that doesn't solve the problem of the source of the financing, because we're still paying for it as a society.
Right. A dollar is a dollar, right? No matter if it comes from the public or private. What you want to do is spend it in the most efficient way possible. So I agree that the basic access to the system should be public, but let's not fool ourselves. We already have, in a sense, a lot of private practice in our healthcare system. We have physicians who are, in effect, paid on a fee-for-service basis. They're not employees of the state. And we have a healthcare system which 30% of what we spend in healthcare does not flow through the public purse. So we are already there, in a sense. I think what's really important, if we're going to push the envelope, is that to make sure that if there's private interests involved, and this is certainly in the case in the physicians, that there's regulation that goes with it, right? So any kind of public-private partnership, if it's going to be a partnership, needs to be very heavily regulated.
By the way, the business of private physicians, basically the only real private physicians are those physicians that have been disengaged themselves from Medicare. And those, it's still a fairly small number. So it's growing very slowly. So, you know, the family physician in his office, called private office, they're paid 100% by Medicare, by the public insurance. It's their practice is all regulated. So, yes, they are private deliverers in a certain sense, but I feel they're really part of the public healthcare system as opposed to the physicians who have disengaged themselves, a very small minority, from Medicare.
Okay. My question relates to the question, the comment mentioned earlier, that among all these countries in the OECD, Canada pays the highest next to the United States. Is that significantly higher per capita for health for similar outcomes? And if are there lessons to be learned from what are done in other countries? Because I've heard comparisons with the United States. We know that it's far more economical doing it the Canadian way, but it's far more expensive doing it the Canadian way compared to, say, in Britain, France, and other countries. What can we do, copy from other countries or learn from other countries that might help us here in Quebec or in Canada?
So yes, healthcare costs in terms of percent of GDP are lower than in the United States, and they're about half in per capita costs. But compared to European countries, Canada is in sort of the breadth of big spenders, but not the most expensive. The most expensive, quote-unquote, countries would be France and Germany, right? So Canada is not as expensive as Switzerland, which is a different kind of a system. But so there are obviously lessons that everyone can learn from everyone. But one of the things in Canada to be conscious of is where the costs are growing the fastest. They're growing the fastest in the services that are not publicly covered. So if there's a way to do something, for example, about pharma, right? Most countries in the European context have pharmacare systems, or pharma is part of the overall healthcare package. That's one way, perhaps. And in many of these countries, primary care is much better developed and better organized than in Canada.
I don't know if the question's appropriate, but from my experience, I feel like in terms of increasing efficiency for the system, I feel like, why don't we use computers more? When I visit the doctor, for example, when I went to my obstetrician, I found that first two residents interviewed me about my medical history. Two residents, so they each took about 20 minutes to hear about my history, and then they took the papers in the file and took me to the doctor in the high-risk section because I'm epileptic, and then my doctor there took notes again, and then so that took another 20 minutes, and then another day I went to the neurology section, and again they took notes. I'm just wondering, why can't we save doctor hours by putting everything in a single, like, file? Because ideally, I think it would be best if we can put it together with a Medicare card, since we have those cards that are connected to our SIN numbers and everything like that. So I think it would be best if our information could be portable as well. But I feel like at least within sections, if not within hospitals, why can't we have systems to put information together so the doctors don't have to write everything down? Because I feel like, you know, the stereotype of the doctor with the messy handwriting. I found that none of the doctors read any of what they had written even in the past, let alone what others wrote for them before them. So it's just I'm just asking out of curiosity. Does it ever come up? that subject on the
wall. You're the doctor.
My handwriting is perfect. I remember my principal in high school said to me, and when I was in grade 10, he said, "You'll never get into university with that handwriting." He didn't know I was going to medicine, where one of the criteria for getting in was having a lousy handwriting. But part of your experience is being in a teaching hospital, by the way, you know, with residents. But the other part, you're absolutely right. And it's hard to figure out, you know, you go everywhere around the world and you have your bank card and you stick it in, and they tell you how much money you have in your bank account at every moment. But why can't we do that? And I don't know the answer, and it's a very, maybe there's a policy issue there. There's also issues around privacy and information, which I think are overblown, because the real privacy information is not because it's on paper, because paper circulates as well. There are places in the United States with the HMOs, there are places in the world where they've developed computerized systems, single files, et cetera, et cetera. You stick in your Medicare card with your chip on the card, and it's done. I don't know why it's taking so long and why it's so complicated here. And it would make things much more efficient for everybody, including the physician. So if you came to see me, I can then stick your card into a computer, and I can pull up, you know, the prescriptions you receive wherever you receive them, for example. You get your blood results, et cetera, et cetera, and see where you were, which doctor you've seen previously, et cetera. It's coming, but it's so slow.
If I could answer something to that, I developed a system for helping with that for my parents when they were both dying of lung cancer at the same time and I couldn't be with them on every visit. My background is in nursing, my mother's too. So we wrote out a system of categories of information and organized it so that they would have it on a firm piece of paper and carry it around to every doctor that they went to and then record all their information from the doctor and then carry it from doctor to doctor. And I've developed that quite a bit. There are about 2,000 little copies of this type of little card in circulation, actually. And I am working at the moment on putting it in electronic form as a personal health record. And the beta testing so far shows it's very successful. And I've tried to sell it to all of the provincial Medicares. All of them want it in their specific electronic form. And I haven't been able to persuade anybody yet to take the model and put it into their own system themselves. So I'm working on it as an individual thing that people could have it in any one of 5 or 6 languages and keep on their person in a BlackBerry and an iPhone and an Android. And then I hope to go back to the paper version, because whenever I speak to seniors groups, they say, forget the electronic group, give us a piece of paper. And but I do think that if people carried a lot of their own information, almost all of this repetition could be avoided and save time for the doctors, could be safer for the doctors. And in my version, I've included a lot of kind of touchy questions that make people look at ways that they could improve their health behaviors without calling them bad health behaviors, and just to try to do some health promotion and disease prevention at the same time as accident prevention works.
I went through law at McGill. We were taught what the law was. That's what you had to know. No one ever taught us about the effect of the law on people. There was zero in terms of the effects of what we were learning and how it worked on society. I suppose that's how sociology came into existence, if not anthropology. At McGill, it's a McGill question. A medical student at McGill, how much is he exposed to the issues that you're raising? Can he or she take a professional interest, still be an oncologist, still be whatever, but nevertheless be very aware of the sort of things that are running through a patient's mind when they've struggled, as we did for 3 years, coming back to Quebec to find a doctor, are aware of the time limits on the resident's ability to deal with this, all that sort of thing. What is there a policy in the medical faculty of introducing doctors in training to the realities of the effect of medicine on people?
The answer is actually yes. The answer is yes, and more and more. So the notion of patient-centered care, the notion of professionalism, we give it all sorts of names. The notion of even changing how we take the so-called medical history, which is often based on what the physician needs to know rather than how the patient can express it and what's important for the patient. So yes, and then the notion of the patient experience, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, that is happening. The other thing that is starting to happen is to a better understanding, teaching a better understanding of the patient in their socioeconomic context, which is also extremely important because we're not all alike and we're not all educated alike. We don't all have a socioeconomic, and when we walk out of the physician's office, we go to very different conditions. So that's the other thing. Finally, what's also starting is to have physicians with an understanding of the impact on the population, so the impact on public health and the healthcare system as a whole. We can note there was a paper called The Physician as a Double Agent, meaning physicians now have to take care of the patient that's in front of them in their office, but have to see that in the context of population health and a system of care. And they're not always exactly the same. And we can no longer say, I just want the best for that person at that time. It's usually not the best when you put it that way. So, yes, these things are happening in medical school and during residency.
And two other things are happening. The way that young people are being recruited into medical school is different. The whole interview process is different. It's all by simulation instead of by rote, so that's really important. And the curriculum is right now in the process of being completely revised for 2013. There's going to be now a module on healthcare policy, on, you know, the stuff that I was talking about, how much things cost and what is the value to society. And that's something that often physicians don't think about either when they're going through their medical school.
Long time ago, say 20, 30 years ago, I never think about healthcare. And when I turned 80, 10 years ago, I started thinking about healthcare. Now, chronic healthcare is not a problem for me. I think it's very good here in Montreal, in Quebec. And in fact, both my parents, they die after unhealthy. After 3 days in the hospital, they pass away. So I'm hoping that will happen to me too. Remain here. I'm 19 years old now. That I hope I can remain functionable. But you never know. You have to think about maybe you need some chronic care. So could any one of you talk about the chronic care system in Montreal? Because all I read about is some institutionalized chronic care facilities have some horrible stories. And also, many people now wanted to remain home. So could any one of you or both of you say something about the chronic care system in Montreal?
What we're talking about is long-term care, and I said that would be for another session. But up to about 20 years ago or so, 25 years ago, there are basically two choices. You were either at home or in a nursing home. And then, and by the way, when nursing homes were created in the 60s, you had to be healthy to get into a nursing home. You had to be continent, mobile. And there was an evolution. The first evolution was being more strict on who could come into a nursing home and who really needed it. The second evolution that started to happen is people started to realize hey, maybe we have to have a range of solutions. So the first is, how much home care can we deliver? And how efficient can that be done? And the second is, what is the range of facilities that people can go to instead of going right to a nursing home level? So 20, 30 years ago, what we call assisted living or apartment hotel, it was just those who had lots and lots of money who could go into it. Now we have a lot. We have two-star, three-star, four-star types of facilities which give more or less services. So the idea is that you stay in a place which is appropriate to the level of care that you need. So that's happening. That's positive. There are problems. There are problems about our capacity to pay and how much services we give, of having people move from one level of care to another. So you have to move instead of, can we have some sort of integrated, etc. But that also is, and governments are realizing, because they're starting to look at the numbers of older people, that we're going to have to become more efficient on how we deliver these services.
Just on a personal note, on chronic care, I mean, I think it's not, it's an elderly situation, but it's a situation through the life cycle, particularly with diseases such as obesity and type 2 diabetes. So if we don't get this chronic care right, we are going to be condemning a lot of people to a lots of suffering in their lives. I think there are lots of better ways we can think about, and I know Dr. Bergman probably has most of the ideas about what to do in terms of trying to coordinate care for these kinds of services. I also have a child who has special needs. You know, this, you're basically on your own in a system in which the idea of, you know, kind of teams taking care or having a point person or a medical home is just, it's like science fiction. It doesn't have to be.
No, now we hear you. No, that was me. You're good.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question about referrals for diagnostic testing and the wait lists for those. Whether whatever kind of gastroscopy, colonoscopy, all kinds of things. So you have a really bad symptom, and there's a waiting list of months, years. So what are we supposed to do? We have to shell out the money to go privately, and we can't afford it. And there seems to be no going back to the Health Act, which has the item of accessibility to it. I'm dumbfounded by how much time people have to wait, and they get sicker and sicker and die even. I have a second question, though. Not too long ago, I was interviewed by Radio Canada on the issue of rationing of health care for old people. It's going to be a documentary, and I wondered whether you had any comments on that.
On the waiting list, that's another complex issue that's partly linked to resources, partly linked to organization. On rationing care, basically every healthcare system in the world rations. There's one form of rationing or another. The American system does it by not covering, now they're starting to cover, but 50 million people. That was their way of rationing. The others got care much more quickly. Our ways of rationing are limiting, the government limits the number of resources it gives to a hospital, for instance. So it'll say, this hospital will give you X number of hips that you could replace.
This is by age.
No.
By age and chronic illnesses.
I'm coming to that. Okay. Rationing by age is not an acceptable concept in any way, shape, or form. Rationing by age to save money is not an acceptable way in any way, shape, or form. However, giving appropriate care is another issue. So it may be appropriate, if we go back to those two people, the gentleman with his bypass surgery, it was extremely appropriate to do bypass surgery on that gentleman. It would have been much less appropriate to do quadruple bypass surgery on that unfortunate lady at that time, at the time that you see her. So the question is not rationing, the question is appropriate care. And so sometimes too much care is inappropriate, sometimes not enough care is inappropriate. So that's really, for me, that's the issue. It's not a question of rationing, it's a question of appropriate care. I don't have an answer for that, except to say that, as I said, it's partly linked to organization and partly linked to resources, and it's a very complex issue. I know, for example, in the issue of, at some point, there was a problem with cataract surgery, waits for cataract surgery, and one of the things they discovered, yes, there could be an issue of resources, the number of cataract surgery we allow, but also a question of how the resources are distributed and how they're used. So certain physicians had a very long wait list and other physicians didn't have at all. And so could you have a way of distributing the work to different physicians? Now that means we accept maybe not to go to the physician that we want to go to, but another one who's much more available. Well, private, somebody has to pay for it. Somebody has to pay for it, whether you're paying for it or whether the government says, I'm going to pay for a private physician to allow you to get that care, we're paying for it. So it doesn't really, that doesn't solve the problem.
We only have time for one last question. I've been told that we've extended our limit, so please.
I am curious, so I want to ask this question. So as far as I know, there's no translation or interpretation services regulated at the McGill University Health Network. I'm just wondering what that means in terms of accessibility to the general population, especially in Canada, and also what that could mean for the success of primary health care if it were to be implemented in Montreal. This is a McGill Montreal specific question.
Do you mean French or English? Or
no, all languages, yeah.
I don't know if that... I've done my work mainly at the Jewish General Hospital, and the two most useless languages are English and French. But so what you try, there's although there's not a formal translation, people are designated, different workers in the hospital are designated who know the different languages and can be called upon. So there's the issue of formally the question of language. But there's also the issue, what that raises, the issue of culturally appropriate care. And so what might be considered culturally appropriate for certain groups, ethnic or cultural groups, may not be for others. So understanding also that, and that's part of training that is going to, that medical students and residents are going to have.
I think it's even deeper than that. I mean, I think it's also about communication, which is the primary, I mean, that's what healthcare is all about, communication. And so it is actually an important issue. In terms of the legal precedents, what we have is the case in British Columbia in which the deaf-mute woman actually won her case in terms of her claim that she had not had appropriate care because she wasn't able to communicate with the hospital, people working at the hospital, and that led to a change in the BC law. But, of course, she was a charter case, right? So her rights were protected under the charter, as they would be for French and English, but for the vast body of other languages, there is no kind of legal protection in that sense.
Thank you. We agree with you.
Well, on behalf of everyone, I really would like to thank Antonia, together with Howard, for the presentation for today. This is the last program that we're going to run for this year for the campus, through the campus community. But as we begin the new year, we will advertise a whole series of new events for the community. Thank you very much for coming, and once again, we thank the speakers.
Thank you,
Antonia. Howard.